This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. California is burning in unprecedented and nightmarish wildfires. Meanwhile, the Gulf Coast is being hit by two storms in succession, Marco and Laura, that will dump a tremendous amount of rain. It's ironic to see catastrophic fires and rains hitting simultaneously like this, but it brings to mind the prophecy of Amos 4, where God says he'll withhold rain from one city, causing it to wither, and cause rain to fall on another city. But very few people pay any respect to such prophecies, showing that God uses weather to correct people. Instead, they've come to view every weather disaster as proof of climate change. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about why this is a problem. The recent peace deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel was a landmark agreement, the first such deal between an Arab nation and the Jews in 26 years. But there are plenty of Muslims who consider it shameful. They say a Muslim should never strike a deal with a Jew. There are two Muslim nations speaking out along these lines, trying to lead the Islamic world, Iran and Turkey. It's creating some important fault lines in the Middle East and beyond. In our second segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about this battle for leadership over radical Islam. We've been hearing about the dangers in Chinese cyber espionage in apps like TikTok, how these can compromise Americans' security. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller says, if you're concerned about online security, you should pay closer attention to what the American government is capable of. He'll give us a report about why spying from the National Security Administration is a bigger threat than TikTok. I'll finish by giving you three reasons why it's important to build more passion in your life. We'll start, though, by talking about these weather disasters hitting America right now. We'll hear this in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
Over 1 million acres of California have burned this week in some of their largest ever fires. Apocalyptic images of orange roadsides, thick plumes of smoke, and blazing trees are all over the news. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated as the approximately 93 active fires have burned over 1.6 million acres of land in California, as well as Arizona, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, and Oregon. Fires burning right now include both the second and third largest in California's history. At the same time, on the other side of the United States, Tropical Storm Marco is being followed by Hurricane Laura, expected to be a Category 3 hurricane when it makes landfall around Louisiana. According to National Weather Service meteorologist Benjamin Schott, the unprecedented thing here is that it's the same state being affected within 48 hours. In modern meteorological history, there's never been anything like this before, where you could have two possible hurricanes hitting within miles of each other over such a short period. And with Marco leaving on Tuesday evening, Louisiana may not have a very large window for rescuers or power restoration crews to respond as Hurricane Marco hits on Wednesday morning. Laura has already hit Haiti and the Dominican Republic, killing at least 12 people. And this Atlantic storm season, which is expected to run through November, could be one of the busiest ever. Laura is the 12th of an expected 25 storms to hit in this entire year. And flooding is a great fear, with New Orleans under threat. And although Tropical Storm Marco was downgraded from a hurricane, it still threatens the Gulf Coast with heavy rain and even the possibility of tornadoes. Clearly, something unusual is happening. As bad as 2019 was with its record-breaking spate of fires, floods, droughts, and hurricanes, 2020 looks like it's only going to be worse. And with all these disasters presently here and on the horizon, almost universally, the unequivocally determined cause has been climate change. Hillary Clinton tweeted, "This week, millions of Americans will face the devastating effects of the kinds of fires and hurricanes climate change has made both more likely and more severe." In a meeting on August 20th, Greta Thunberg urged Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, to be brave enough to think long term in a meeting with her on the quote-unquote climate crisis. Elizabeth Warren called the climate crisis an existential threat. Ilhan Omar said the climate crisis is real and it is happening now. California State Governor Gavin Newsom tweeted, "If you don't believe in climate change, come to California." Today's environmentalism almost universally attributes climate change as the cause of weather disasters. Even the press itself is completely sold on this idea. The New York Intelligencer has an article titled, "Climate Change Has Led to Extreme Wildfires in California." Everyone is blaming global warming. The USA Today even wrote that California shows us the future of climate change. Even North Carolina State News is reporting that climate change is going to affect things as mundane as how beer tastes. More people than ever before view climate change as a real significant issue. According to a 2018 survey, 59% of Americans believe climate change is a major threat to the well-being of the country. Of 23 surveyed countries, 68% see climate change as a major threat, and 13 of those countries view it as the top threat their nation faces, ahead of North Korea's nuclear weapons program, terrorism, and cyber attacks. The climate change crusade is making an immense impact. But as universally accepted as it is, climate change is not the problem. When climate disasters occur, the usual political and media response is to blame the trend on climate change. The worse the disaster, the louder the calls for taking action against climate change by addressing the supposed man-made causes such as carbon emissions and the use of fossil fuels. This view about climate change has taken hold of millions of minds around the world, and it's often presented as an irrefutable scientific fact. But why is this so dangerous? What is so wrong about declaring climate change as the reason for all these devastating weather-related events? The truth is that this ideology, this idea that climate change is responsible for all these terrible disasters, is the exact opposite of what God says. Human activity does cause problems. The environment is harmed by the industrial release of synthetic compounds, the replacement of forests with cities and asphalts, and the gaseous release from the exhaust of cars, planes, and trains. But there is another, far more significant reason for these disasters, and it is spiritual in nature. This mainstream and almost universally accepted threat of climate change is a deadly deception. Many often ask why God allows such disasters to strike. Some believe that these disasters themselves are proof that there is no God. However, one reason God does send storms is for correction. Yes, sometimes God bathes the earth with gentle rain to show his loving concern and mercy, and other times God uses the weather to correct people. Do you believe in that God? The danger in the climate change deception is that it blinds us to our sins, the real cause of all these disasters. This in turn makes it impossible to identify the only effective solution: repentance. Climate change is a dangerous misdiagnosis that offers ineffective solutions to these disasters. The Bible, however, shows us the true cause for these disasters and the real, lasting solution.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Rufaro. You brought out the fact that, not just that climate change is causing these problems. That's kind of the consensus view now, but that it is irrefutably causing all of these problems. And if you don't accept it, then you are anti-science. And as you were talking about that, I was just thinking how that's essentially the same thinking that we're seeing behind coronavirus these days, that this very strong consensus has emerged. Science says you must wear a mask, you must practice social distancing. If you disagree, you're anti-science. But the reality is that there's a lot of evidence to show that it's not that simple. With respect to coronavirus, there's a lot of evidence to show that wearing masks isn't necessarily the most helpful thing, that there's a lot of things that we don't necessarily know about the virus, but they're acting like it's settled science. That's essentially what you have happening with respect to these weather disasters as well.
That's exactly right. And it's interesting that both coronavirus and climate change have joined forces in some senses with a recent show on CNN with an anchor saying that coronavirus has helped humanity buy some much needed time against global warming.
Right.
It makes the assumption that global warming is a real thing that is affecting society and that coronavirus is something that's helping with that. It's saying that the virus, it claims that the virus came from too much deforestation happening in the world. Mm. And that is just, in microcosm, the entire idea behind both the coronavirus crisis and global warming. It's just making these assumptions. Nobody even questions it anymore. It just shows you how much it's swept into society and the way that people think. Nobody even questions it anymore. And now we see this happening where, as these disasters are happening in California, happening in Louisiana and in Texas, it's already a foregone conclusion that climate change is at the heart of it. And that's what's really dangerous, because when you assume that you've arrived at the true cause, you stop looking for the real cause. Mm-hmm. And then the thing keeps happening again and again and again, and you can't figure out the solution because you've misidentified the problem.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to overlook the fact that the alignment between these two movements really comes down to the fact that they don't like the economic engine that fuels America, that they're trying to basically put the brakes on that. And so coronavirus has done a spectacular job of that, far beyond what any of the drumbeat over climate change was able to accomplish. So you do hear the environmentalists basically saying, well, this is great, we just have to make these changes permanent. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Once you get into that mindset that you're looking for, you know, anything that goes wrong, it's climate change, then you are overlooking, if God is trying to correct through weather, and there are a whole lot of Bible verses, a whole lot of passages that say that's exactly what God is doing. If people don't accept it as correction, if they don't even recognize that that's the cause of it, then they're never going to respond the way that God would want them to. We do appreciate that, Rufaro. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about climate change and some of the disasters that are hitting the United States right now. He's working on an article for thetrumpet.com about this. Go check that out at the website. Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming in.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The landmark peace deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel is causing a lot of reaction. Many Arab nations could follow the UAE's example, but other Muslim nations say the deal is a disgrace, including Iran and Turkey, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
Change comes fast to the Middle East. In 2011, it was the Arab Spring that spread like a fire from west to east across North Africa, with the Arab street rising up to take down longtime autocratic rulers and attempt to replace them with the mob rule. In 2020, it's a more hopeful change. The state of Israel going from pariah to partner with Arab states. 2 weeks ago, the United Arab Emirates, the powerful Gulf monarchy led by the reformist Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, decided to normalize ties with Israel without demanding any significant concessions of the Jewish state. And yesterday, for the first time in history, Sudan allowed a jet to land in Khartoum, flying directly from Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. Aboard the plane was United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, bringing with him glad tidings from the Jewish state as he looks to mediate another peace deal between the nations on the behalf of President Trump. From Sudan, Pompeo is to fly to Bahrain, the UAE, and potentially other Gulf states to encourage others to make pacts with Israel. The fact that an American Secretary of State is traveling through the Middle East promoting a policy of Israeli reconciliation is not hugely surprising in itself. What is surprising is the ease at which the Arab states are now open to the possibility. In the October issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, we showed you how the Bible prophesies of such peace deals with Arab states and that the end result is going to be a double cross of the Jewish state. As we address, the UAE-Israel deal shows how the Middle East is becoming increasingly polarized, with two sides pitted against the other. On one side is the Islamic regime of Iran and its proxies, and on the other side is the Gulf states, Jordan, Israel, Egypt, and other nations threatened by Iran's hegemonic ambitions. By brokering the deal, President Trump is hoping that if the Arab states can just band together with Israel, there'll be enough collective deterrence to keep the Islamic regime at bay and extricate the United States from the Middle East once and for all. Naturally, Iran condemned the deal. Iranian Parliamentary Speaker Mohammad Bakir Kalibaf spoke to a session of lawmakers saying, quote, "The agreement between the dynasty ruling the UAE and the Zionist regime is a clear betrayal of human values, Islamic teachings, the Islamic Ummah, and the Palestinian cause," end quote. The only other Middle Eastern nation to speak against the deal was Turkey. In Istanbul, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told reporters, quote, "The move against Palestine is not a step that can be stomached," end quote. He then threatened to remove his ambassador from the UAE. It's understandable why Iran would be upset, but why Turkey? And why is it that the Gulf states are not just worried about Iran, but also the nation of Turkey? The truth is that both Iran and Turkey are now vying for leadership over the Islamic world. They both consider what the UAE did as a betrayal of Islam. They both hold to the view that the entire Muslim world, the Ummah, should be united under one leader. Erdogan, a follower of Sunni Islam, believes it should be him, and the Ayatollah Khamenei, the Shiite supreme leader, believes he's the best fit. But the Bible reveals which one will be supreme. For the past two decades, Turkish strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan has stripped the nation of its secular status, instead choosing the path of Islamic rule. In 2015, Turkey experienced an attempted coup to remove Erdogan from power, and after the coup failed, Erdogan gutted the military, long the bastion of secular Turkey, of any dissenters to his rule. Since that time, Erdogan has continued to consolidate his rule, squash democracy, and espouse a return to the Islamic faith. The latest sign of Turkey's tilt towards theocracy came as recently as last month, when Erdogan turned the Hagia Sophia from a museum into a mosque. However, it's not just that Erdogan is tilting Turkey towards an Islamic state that worries the Gulf states. It is the fact that Erdogan is now trying to expand Turkey's influence throughout the region through troop deployments. Currently, Turkey has ongoing military campaigns in Libya, Syria, and Iraq. It's busy expanding its territorial holdings in the eastern Mediterranean. And last week, there were reports that Turkey has sent arms to Sunni militias in Lebanon. Critically, though, Turkey is also now the home base for the Muslim Brotherhood, a broad network of Sunni groups that seeks to restore Islamic rule to the Middle East and beyond. While Iran has its highly visible proxies across the Middle East, like Hezbollah, the Houthis, and the Shiite militias in Iraq, The Muslim Brotherhood generally keeps a lower profile, using soft power and infiltration into the hearts and minds of the people to effect change. It is this network of Islamist forces that are equally concerning to the Arab states because they are embedded within each nation. According to Western diplomats who spoke to the New York Times, the Crown Prince of the UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, known also as MBZ, is also obsessed with two enemies, both Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what Central Asia foreign policy specialist Kamran Bakari wrote on August 19th. Quote, "What's more alarming from the UAE point of view is Turkish backing for Islamist forces, particularly those affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood-style Islamists are the only organized group that has come close to forming governments in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, which the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt have all struggled to contain." End quote. In the days following the deal with Israel, it was revealed that the United States was considering selling the F-35 jet to the UAE. The stealth fighter jet is the most sophisticated in the United States fleet and only recently had sold some to Israel. More importantly, and with the connection to Turkey, Trump refused to sell that fighter jet to Turkey earlier this year after a dispute. Having a number of these F-35s would not only provide the UAE with more assets to counter Iran, but also to counter Turkey, which might be the reason why the UAE decided to do the deal with Israel in the first place, in part to get these F-35s to counter Iran, but also Turkey. And containing Turkey, according to the UAE, means countering the power that Turkey has over the Muslim Brotherhood. Put together, we see that the UAE deal with Israel and its aftermath has exposed that the Middle East is becoming an increasingly bipolar area, with the moderate Arab states on the one side and the Islamist governments of Turkey and Iran on the other. However, even that view is incredibly simplistic. In reality, this bipolar world has leaders of Arab states, such as MBZ and the other Arab states, that recognize the dangers of the spread of political Islam espoused by Turkey and Iran on one side, and on the other, you have the Arab street, the majority of the people in the Middle East that do not want peace with Israel. For decades, the Muslim populations of these nations have been told that the Jewish state is an enemy and at the root of Middle Eastern problems. While it varies from state to state, anti-Israel sentiment is firmly established in Arab media, education, culture, including those nations now ready to link arms with Israel. In fact, many Arabs inside these states now at peace with Israel would read this in the Quran, quote, "And hold fast together by the rope which Allah stretches out for you, and be not divided among yourselves." And again, quote, "Those who are with him are strong against unbelievers, compassionate amongst each other." And one more, "Take not my enemies and yours as friends or protectors." That's from the Quran, and that's what the people read. And yet here you have the Arab world, the Muslim world, divided, and yet some of them are making peace with enemies, instead of with the other Muslim nations. Arab leaders like MBZ may be able to make the switch to ally with Israel over security considerations, but have their Arab populations, steeped in the education of Islam, so malleable? And for this reason, diplomats said to the New York Times last year that Prince Mohammed has long argued that the Arab world is not ready for democracy. Islamists would win any elections. According to MBZ, 80% of the soldiers in his forces would answer the call of some holy man in Mecca, he once told American diplomats. This is also why when Egypt, the largest state of the Arabs, had its first free election in 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate was elected in an overwhelming victory. As Israel's ties with the moderate Arab states' leadership continues to improve, watch the growth of the great Islamic movements of Shiite Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood currently led from Turkey. Eventually, the Bible reveals that these movements will indeed combine into one united Islamic nation that will, in fact, push the world towards war. However, as Trumpet editor Gerald Flurry proves in his book, The King of the South, Iran and not Turkey is going to be the single leader of radical Islam. Fundamental to this understanding is a passage of scripture found in Daniel 11 and verse 40 to 43, which shows that there is only one king of the south. Verse 43 shows that this king is going to be allied with both Egypt and Libya, countries that already have strong ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. As in 2011, we can expect the Muslim Brotherhood to return to power in Egypt. And as it does, prophecy indicates that it will look to Iran for leadership, not to Turkey. This means that there's soon going to be a fundamental change in Turkey's politics that will cast Iran as the sole leader of political Islam. Israel's deals with the leaders of the Arab world may bring some temporary stability to the Middle East, but it's also going to alienate Arab leaders from their populations more and more. In some countries, that alienation will turn to outright rebellion. Change is indeed coming to the Middle East, and only biblical prophecy can provide the answers to where events will lead. Historically, events in the Middle East have always impacted the rest of the world, and the Bible says that this will be the case at the end time too. If you haven't yet, please read Gerald Flory's book, The King of the South, to guide you in your understanding.
That was trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall speaking about Iran and Turkey in a battle for leadership of the radical Islamic world. He wrote about this in a trumpet brief yesterday. This is our free daily email service. It has an analysis from one of our writers each day and links to the content on our website that helps you to understand your world. Sign up for the trumpet brief at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The mobile app TikTok has come under scrutiny for being a possible tool for China to spy on Americans. But concerns about online security should include threats far closer to home, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
The Communist Party of China may be spying on you. The popular video sharing platform TikTok collects troves of personal data from its users. If you use this app, the company ByteDance has your age, your phone number, your GPS location, the phone numbers of your contacts, the social media information from your contacts, your browsing history, and the content of text messages you exchange with the app. And since ByteDance is an internet technology company based in Beijing, people are concerned that their data is being turned over to the Chinese government. Yet they should be concerned about a lot more than TikTok's ties to Xi Jinping's dictatorship. If you are an American adult, it's more likely than not that China has stolen your personal data. That's the assessment of Christopher Wray, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He made those statements on July 7th at the Hudson Institute. The House of Representatives voted on July 20th to bar federal employees from downloading the TikTok app on government-issued devices. And President Donald Trump issued an executive order on August 6th directing the Secretary of Commerce to come up with a list of TikTok-related transactions that should be banned in America. ByteDance is trying to sue the U.S. government over this executive order, but the Trump administration is adamant that it helps prevent the Chinese government from spying on American citizens. But while all this is going on, there is an ironic and eerie silence. Neither Google LLC nor Apple Incorporated has commented on the debate over TikTok. Why not? Possibly because these companies also collect enormous amounts of data on U.S. citizens, and citizens might not like how they are using it. Most U.S. social media users are not worried about Google like they are worried about ByteDance, because they do not think Google is deliberately leaking their personal information to a totalitarian government. Yet those who trust Google LLC or Apple Inc. with their personal data should consider that a number of National Security Administration whistleblowers have warned that the United States has a technological capacity to quickly establish a totalitarian surveillance state far worse than the one in the People's Republic of China. Mobile security experts say TikTok's data collection practices are no worse than the data collection practices of U.S. technology companies like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Facebook infamously allowed the data firm Cambridge Analytica unauthorized access to the personal data of 87 million users, including their work history and their political views. Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat have also been involved in huge data breach scandals. In a 2016 Foreign Policy article entitled "Every Move You Make," James Bamford wrote, "Over his two terms, Barack Obama created the most powerful surveillance state the world has ever seen. Although other leaders may have created more oppressive spying regimes, none has come close to constructing one of equivalent size, breadth, cost, and intrusiveness. From 22,000 miles in space, where seven advanced Orion crafts now orbit, to a 1 million square foot building in the Utah desert that stores data intercepted from personal phones, emails, and social media accounts, to taps along the millions of miles of undersea cables that encircle the Earth like yarn, U.S. surveillance has expanded exponentially since Obama's inauguration on January 20th, 2009. Everyone knows American tech companies have enormous amounts of data on hundreds of millions of Americans. Much of that data is personal, and a lot of it is sensitive. And there is evidence that U.S. tech companies have indeed turned over personal data to the U.S. government. There's evidence that they're doing it right now as you listen to this program. In 2013, former government contractor Edward Snowden provided proof of a program called PRISM. This was a spying program in which nine major tech companies provided Obama's NSA and FBI with their users' email messages, audio and video recordings, photographs, documents, and location data. The companies collaborating with PRISM included Apple, AOL, Dropbox, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Paltalk, Skype, Yahoo, and YouTube. And their collaboration with the U.S. government raises the interesting question, what did the Obama administration need all this data for? The editor-in-chief of the Guardian News website noted in 2013 that the dystopian novelist George Orwell could never have imagined anything as complete as this, this concept of scooping up everything all the time. This is something potentially astonishing about how life could be lived and the limitations of human freedom. In Orwell's novel 1984, the government uses microphones, video cameras, and two-way television screens to spy on the population. Today, millions of Americans using computers and smartphones are continuously connected to data, data that can be tracked. The government has a capacity for mass surveillance unlike anything previously imagined, and it is using that capacity. Another NSA whistleblower, William Binney, told James Bamford that the NSA was building a turnkey totalitarian state. Although the U.S. is obviously not totalitarian like communist nations and dictatorships, it has installed all the parts necessary. All that it is needed is for the right people to turn the key. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has written a new article, The Hidden Message of the Horowitz Report. This article exposes how Barack Obama and his administration tried to use the power of the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation to create a dossier of propaganda against political rival Donald Trump, to use that dossier to fraudulently spy on the Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, and to frame Donald Trump for illegally colluding with the Russian government to win the 2016 presidential election. Now, if deep state agents were able to do these sorts of things to the president-elect of the United States, what could they do to you? The answer to this question is far more relevant than the answer to what China is planning to do with TikTok data. The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the English-speaking peoples who settled the U.S. and Britain are the descendants of ancient Israel. This astonishing truth means that the Bible's end-time prophecies concerning Israel are directed at the United States and Britain. And one of these end time prophecies foretells of a time when God would use a human leader to temporarily save Israel from being completely destroyed. In 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 27, it says, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, and there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Lord said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash." Many people believe that if Hillary Clinton had won the 2016 presidential election, the deep state officials who were building the turnkey totalitarian apparatus William Binney warned about would have been able to continue running the country behind the scenes, thus ending our constitutional republic. The only reason this did not happen is that God showed mercy and raised up a flawed human leader to expose what was happening. Millions of Americans are waking up to the threat that this sprawling network of deep state departments presents to the nation. But they still do not understand the root cause behind this crisis. The Bible reveals the serious problems in America's government are not caused by one man or group of government officials. Ultimately, they are caused by the sins of the American people as a whole. Only repentance by the people can prevent the sickness in America's government from escalating into full-scale revolution.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So it's an interesting question. You ask the question in your report there. If the government has the ability to do what it did to Donald Trump via Carter Page, if they can attack a president-elect in the way that they did, what might they do to you? And I just wonder if you have thoughts about what they might do to the average American. Because I think in some ways you hear a question like that and you think, well, what, you know, they had maybe a good reason to go after Donald Trump just to meet their political aims, but why would they come after the average American?
Right. I mean, there's several ways you can answer that question. And like you brought up, the most immediate one is that like someone like Carter Page, who's supporting a political candidate that the people in the government don't like, you can search their history, find out certain things about them, spin those things in a way to get like warrants to spy on them, leave out the parts you don't want in there, put in the parts you do want in there, and it basically gives you the ability to take down political opponents. But even for people, I guess, yeah, you could argue that you're like, well, that's dangerous if you're in the opposition political party. But for people who aren't involved in politics, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But but you don't need too much imagination to see what you could use to something like that. You just have to look at like, well, what are Russia and China doing with surveillance states with much less technological capacity than America's ones? To where, and you hear all these stories about, I don't know, someone says something on online against Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, and they're either fined or arrested or reprimanded, to where you're almost afraid to speak your mind, even over text or social media or or in some cases even in the privacy of your own home, because if you're criticizing government policies that you're not allowed to criticize, especially in an internet age. I mean, the government finds out about it and can reprimand you for that. You even see that a little bit in the United States already, not necessarily government enforced that we know of,
right?
But where someone quotes a verse from the Bible about transgenders and then loses their job over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there really is that movement to restrict free speech and to punish people who fall afoul of the liberal orthodoxy or the leftist orthodoxy in this country. If you get leftist leaders in power who decide, and they've talked, you know, you listen to the Democratic presidential candidates and they're talking about restricting hate speech and whatever they may define that to be, that they feel like they're obligated to use whatever tools they have at their disposal to be able to do that.
Right. And dredging up, I mean, in some cases, you'll hear people lose their jobs for comments they made years ago that, I mean, and I guess they made it in a public interview or something, so people know about it. But now, like I said, just with this, that's what I think the editor of The Guardian was getting at when he said that, like, George Orwell couldn't even imagine this, because there's a, if you've read his book 1984, there's like one scene where the protagonist is talking to his romantic partner about some opinions he has against the government, and then they get arrested for it because there was a hidden television screen behind the wall. Which that's kind of quaint technology now to think of a two-way television screen, because in that book you're even there, like, you move your desk out of the way of the TV screen. But now, where so much of your communication is over your smartphone or on the internet or just satellite surveillance technology, like I said, there is just this capacity to scoop up every bit of information. I think I'd even saw an interview a while back from the judicial analyst Andrew Napolitano talking about that. Really, he said that the NSA, I mean, it's cooperating with these phone companies. It's scooping up all the phone transcripts. He says all the president has to do is ask for a phone transcript, and he can get it. Now, oftentimes they don't, because there's a record of that. So if Congress investigates him for doing that, they can find out he made the request. Andrew Napolitano was talking about, he said that's why the Obama administration worked so much with the British intelligence during the Russia collusion investigations of President Trump, is that if President Obama asked the British intelligence service for a transcript, Congress can't investigate them. If they ask the NSA, he's like, said he can get it, which is kind of terrifying to think about, that, like, he can get any phone or the president of the United States can get any phone conversation he wants, as long as he's willing to have a record someplace that he made the request.
It's hard to imagine this happening in the United States, but you do see evidence of just how much there are people who want to wield power to the degree that you're describing. Thank you for that, Andrew. We've been talking to trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the remarkable spying capabilities of the American government through the NSA. He's working on an article about this. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Carmen Gallo is a communication coach. He has studied and evaluated the most popular TED Talks. These are videos with speakers from all over the world giving inspirational and educational talks on a variety of subjects. And some of these videos have been viewed millions of times. The most popular of them have been viewed over 10 million times. So there's obviously something really working in these talks. And Carmen Gallo wrote a book called Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. And he divided his book into 3 parts. These are 3 qualities that are common to all of the most engaging presentations. The first is that they are emotional. The second, that they are novel. They teach something new. And the third is that they're memorable. That first section on emotion, and the first chapter of that section, the very first thing that this man covers is about passion. He says, science shows that passion is contagious, literally. You cannot inspire others unless you are inspired yourself. You stand a much greater chance of persuading and inspiring your listeners if you express an enthusiastic, passionate, and meaningful connection to your topic. Now, what works for public speaking actually works for life. In order to really succeed at something, in order to really accomplish something important, you need passion for it. If you're not passionate about it, you just won't accomplish much success at that thing. I want to give you three reasons why passion is so important, why it's something that you should seek to build more of in your life. The first is that passion inspires action. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about emotion as being an impulse toward an action. We are, according to Scripture, we are to be doers of the word. It's one thing to learn about something or maybe get an idea that, yeah, I should be doing that. It's another thing to actually follow through and take that action. Generally, if you don't feel it, you probably won't do it. You just don't do things that you don't want to do, at least not for very long. So passion inspires the action that you need to take in your life. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Nothing great has ever been achieved without enthusiasm." The second reason why we need to build passion is that passion surmounts obstacles. Whenever you're trying to do something important, there are always things that get in the way, and it is easy to kill motivation if that motivation is weak. But if you're passionate about something, that can really help you break through those obstacles. I read a book about George Lucas and the making of the movie Star Wars back in the 1970s. And this book just detailed all of the setbacks and the problems that he experienced in trying to get this movie made. There was so many things about it that were so unusual, and there were a lot of people that really didn't believe that this was going to be successful at all. But Mr. Lucas had a vision, and he kept pressing, and he kept navigating ways around all of these obstacles. He had impressive determination because he was so passionate about getting this movie made. And it was because of that passion that he was able to surmount those obstacles and get so many people on board. It ended up being one of the most successful movies in history. It never would have happened without the passion that surmounts obstacles. The third reason why passion is so important is that passion is contagious. You know, it's very difficult to get other people to make changes in their lives. It's very difficult to convince people to actually follow through and take action, even if they believe that it's the right thing to do. Well, passion is a crucial ingredient to even have a shot at helping someone to change. If you're a teacher, if you are a parent, you're trying to inspire someone to make changes in their lives, you have to be passionate if you have a shot at really inspiring other people. Baldwin said, "Fires cannot be made with dead embers, nor can enthusiasm be stirred by spiritless men." We need to have passion if we're going to really help other people. Now, when passion is directed at the right things, it is a very godly virtue, and it matters to all of us if we're going to be able to accomplish much of anything. It is a great virtue. Isaiah 9 and verse 7 talks about God in this way: "Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this." This is talking about the zeal of the Eternal, the passion of God that leads to him getting results, establishing peace and order and judgment and justice, changing lives. God is zealous. God is passionate. We need to build that zeal and that passion in our lives. That will inspire action. It will surmount obstacles, and it will spread to others, giving it a multiplying effect that can really accomplish great things. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Rufao Manyepa, Brent Noctegal, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from John F. Kennedy. Do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger men. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.